Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August the 14th, 1999, and in Koinonia Fireside Room this morning is Ralph Milton's session, Struggle and Hope, number 99-10. Let's listen in.
Human beings are capable of many things, including being able to think in at least two different ways. There is the rational and the non-rational. The rational way is when you think very carefully through a problem and analyze it. I know some of you have heard this before, but just bear with me. You think it through, you gather all the evidence, and you come to a solution. And most of us think that we think most of the time that way. I don't think we do, but that's what most of us think. That's how you tie your shoes. That's how you got here via airplanes and boats and things. That's the origin of technology and so forth, and I would not want to do without it. But I think our religious thinking happens in another plane, a complementary one, called non-rational. And by non-rational, I mean the poetic thinking, the metaphorical thinking. You all know what a metaphor is? A metaphor is when you use a kind of a snapshot to describe something that you can't describe any other way. For instance, you could say that a car went through here like a streak of light. Well, you know, like a streak of light is a metaphor. It's not true. The car wasn't really traveling. But when you want to, you know, really emphasize that, you use those non-rational ways. Now, the best way of describing this is a rainbow. If you say there is a rainbow here and the colors of the rainbow are made by the refraction of light on the droplets of water, which splits the light into its component light waves and so forth, that would be a rational description of the rainbow. If you say, oh, that's beautiful, that's just marvelous. I can see a symbol there of God's covenant promise to us. That would be non-rational. Now, there is no conflict between the two. Both statements can be fully true. I believe that we do most of our religious thinking in non-rational forms. And one of the ways we do that is through stories. And the Bible is a wonderful source book of stories. One of the reasons why the Bible is still being read and is still the world's number one bestseller is because of the stories in it. Those stories speak to us because we can see ourselves in the story. So today the theme is hope. And I'm going to do a little fun exercise with you first and then simply read you a series of stories that, as I believe, have to do with hope. At least that was in my heart when I was writing them. Okay, first of all, a contest. And the prize is a free trip to Disney World. What you have to do, I'm going to read you several descriptions of God. And if you can pick the right one, you win a free trip to Disney World. Some of you already think this is a trick question. You think I don't really have a trip to Disney World, right? Yeah, okay, well, I'll show you. Okay. Here are some descriptions of God. God the general. God sits up there in command headquarters directing the troops down here on Earth. If the infantry gets a bit outnumbered, General God can always bring in the Air Force, the angels, to join in the battle. General God is always totally on your side and against the enemy, whoever that happens to be on that day. Okay, God the general. God the coach. If you pay attention to the signals from the bench, you'll win for sure. But Coach God has scruples. If you don't play by the rules, you'll get benched. You might even get knocked off the team. That's number two, God the coach. God the computer hack. This God doesn't care at all what happens to us. Computer hack God set up the world, worked out all the programs, booted up the system, typed in the do command, and then went on to invent something else. It doesn't much matter how many bugs the software has, computer hack God is busy with other things and really doesn't care. Computer hack God. God the cop. Here comes the fuzz. The constable god has your little computer brain hotwired into master control, and if you press the wrong button or try to access a protected file or get your pinkies into the wrong cookie jar, El Zapo, God will get you for that. God the cop. God the rock star. Some people think of God as a prima donna artist, a very popular, flamboyant superstar who has lots of fans, lots of money, lots of connections, and above all, lots of ego. If you want to be part of it, you've got to be one of the groupies who follows the star around saying flattering things, giving the star credit for everything good that happens, and taking responsibility yourself for everything bad. When you're in with the star, you've got it made. A variation of this superhero god is one who will fly in and zap the bad guys, do marvelous miracles for the fans, and make you feel good all over. That's God the rock star, okay? God the kindergarten teacher. As long as you're in school, kindergarten teacher God will feed you cookies, wipe your runny nose, and give you a hug when you cry. This god will also help you put on dry clothes if you mess your pants. But once you leave kindergarten, you're on your own. God the social worker. God is very helpful, but only in the sense of giving really good advice. You still have to make your own decisions and take responsibility for them. And the social worker god is ready to talk to anyone needing a bit of advice. A variation of this is the idea of God as a best friend, someone who is with you all the time, who provides moral support when you're feeling down, and goes for long walks with you when you're feeling depressed. That's God the social worker. God the parent. God is a very good, very caring parent. The parent god, traditionally referred to as father, but sometimes also as mother, is loving and tender and has read all the books on how to raise children to be mature and responsible adults. Parent God hurts when the kids mess up, but even so, Parent God knows that the only way for the kids to grow is to let them do what they need to do. They've got to have freedom, totally. The Parent God respects us and believes passionately that we can and will grow up. The parent god gets really upset when the kids fight with each other or refuse to share things with each other. God the lover. Like the parent god in many ways, lover god has read all the human potential literature and wants us to be totally free to love back. So lover god is never manipulative or bossy. There's always a shoulder to cry on, and when you ask, lover god will be ready to go to bat for you. There are a bunch of Christian songs written about the lover god, and yes, they are slightly erotic, and that ain't necessarily bad. God the artist. God loves to make beautiful things, trees and ducks and people and worlds. The artist god is wildly extravagant, using up the whole universe for a star-studded, micro-punctuated gallery. It's a living art exhibit, and the show keeps changing. God has appointed the human race as the curator of this magnificent gallery. We're asked to look after it, to keep it neat and tidy, to love it and appreciate the intricate, delicate beauty of it all, and to make sure there is no vandalism. Okay. Who's ready to guess which one of those is correct? What? I mean, here I give you all these pictures of God and you can't pick the right one? Yes? All of them? That's half the answer. None of them is the other half. And the simple fact is that the human mind is simply incapable of defining God. We can take all kinds of runs at it, and we can, you know, and God, I'm sure, sits up there and chuckles and says, closed but no cigar. You know, I mean, we can't do that. And yet, there is that sense that God is there, somewhere, within us, outside of us, around us, and calling us to lead a life of hope. So what I want to do is to read you some stories about hope. And these are biblical stories. No, sorry. First of all, there's a story that is not biblical, but it's a story about hope. Nobody organized it. I don't remember hearing it from anyone. But we got up at 3 a.m. We took a large thermos filled with thick, hot chocolate as we walked quietly to the beach. We knew most of our village would be there as well. The year was 1965. We lived in the little city of Dumaguete in the central Philippines. Two amateur Japanese astronomers, Ikea and Seki, had discovered a new, spectacular, sun-grazing comet. We soon learned it could be seen rising from the ocean just before dawn. It was so dark as only a moonless tropical night can be dark. Our slippered feet seemed to have strange awareness of the familiar road we couldn't see. Our eyes were on the soft black outline of coconut palms near the beach. We walked without speaking. I held Bev's hand, and 4-year-old Carrie clutched mine. Brave Mark, now almost 6, walked very close to Bev, carrying the chocolate. "Dad, look at the stars," he whispered. I had been trying to see the black road. I hadn't noticed. "Yes, look at them, my son," I thought to myself. "Look at them with all the wonder of your almost 6-year-old eyes, because you will never see them this way again." I felt Carrie's cheek against my hand. The quiet coolness of the sea brushed our faces as we neared the beach and smelled the soft smell of the coral sea. Tiny reflections of stars sparkled on the gentle swell as it lapped the sand, blending its rhythm with the musical Cebuano spoken by tiny groups of people we couldn't see in the darkness. Then, from a few yards down the beach, a muted exclamation, "Sus!" A soft halo of blue-orange light had begun to trace the edge of Sikihor Island hulking on the horizon. Almost imperceptibly, the halo grew, till now it was a soft-edged fan, painted with quiet watercolor strokes upward from the island. Tiny stars sparkled through the colors. Suddenly, so far away, the universe given dimension by the broad tail of a comet close to Earth. I thought I knew what comets looked like. I remember them from my childhood, inch-long pictures in a book. But this comet rose, tail first, spreading its pale fire up and up. Soon it pained our necks to see the top, straight up above our heads, a huge half-open fan. We couldn't see it all at once, but swept our eyes up and down the gentle orange-blue fire, so soft in places we wished the stars would dim so we could see the fragile colors. Far out on the sea, the shout of fisherfolk announced the first catch of the morning. The first streaks of dawn encroached upon our comet. As if to win the race with sunlight, the bright, pale, golden coma freed itself suddenly from behind the silhouette of Sikihor Island, then stretched its paleness from horizon to the brightening black of sky above us. And we tiny humans gathered on that beach applauded. We clapped our hands for our comet to hear, clapped and cheered, and then fell silent as it faded from sight before the morning sun. For several moments we sat there, 100 people from a tiny village, looking to each other's eyes to see reflected there our miracle. The Southern Cross flickered its benediction as it too faded into the sun. Then someone in a soft Cebuano said the ancient words, "When I look at your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and stars that you have ordained, who are we that you think of us? Fragile humans, that you care for us." And wordless, we all walked home. Once in a while in our lives, we have those moments, those beautiful, marvelous moments when for just a moment, we look into the face of God, and then it disappears into life. And we struggle to recapture those times. Sometimes we do when you are hiking around here or looking at these mountains or seeing the doe with her little fawn that's been up and around here, or maybe if you're really lucky you saw the bear with her cubs. These are moments when you can just for a moment glimpse the face of God. So when you have those, note them, treasure them. It's not that most of us have not seen the face of God in some way. It's just that we don't pay close enough attention. We need to, when we see these things, find a way of marking them in our memories. I do it by writing them down. There are other ways of doing it, but marking these moments so that they can feed us. Because times will come, as they probably have for many of you come already, when you will be facing great pain, great struggle, and perhaps certainly death at some point. All right, let's go back and look at the story of Joseph. Now, you all know the story of Joseph and his coat of many colors, and how he was a little braggart. You know, he was a real snotty-nosed kid. If you ever, when he used to have dreams in which he dreamed that his brothers and his father and mother would bow down to him, and the brothers finally got so annoyed at him, some of them wanted to kill him, the rest of them sold him off into slavery into Egypt. And so this teenage kid was sold into slavery into a country where he didn't speak the language, and by dint of just plain bloody-minded determination stayed alive and rose to the top of the anthill. And then one day his brothers came and they tried to buy food from him. Now you think of this, these brothers and this younger brother from a highly dysfunctional family. I mean, dysfunctional to the max. There's a wonderful word in the story. After Joseph has finally revealed himself to the brothers and said who he is, and there's a bunch of stuff goes on, and there's this one little phrase, it says, and then the brothers talked with each other. Well, I guess, eh? They would have a lot of talking to do. And that's what got me going on this story. The sobs heaved out of his body. One after another, his large, muscular frame was racked with grief and pain he'd never known himself to feel until this moment. Joseph had never known how to cry. His life had been a struggle to survive, to prevail, to prosper, to overcome. Joseph survived on his wits. He was the only Hebrew in the Egyptian court, and his very life depended on his ability to be one jump ahead of everyone else. There was no time, no room for weakness ever. Certainly no time for tears. But now he was weak. Curled up like a small boy on the edge of his ornate official chair, Joseph wept the tears he should have wept all through his troubled life. Joseph wept the tears of anger, anger at his abusive brothers who years before had beat him, stripped him of his long-sleeved coat, thrown him in a pit, and sold him into slavery. Anger at the Egyptians for whom he had slaved, whom he had outwitted, and over whom he now ruled. Anger at himself for this spoiled brat younger brother he had been, for all the lies he had told, and all the people he had used. Joseph wept the tears of loneliness and fear. Torn from his family, thrown into slavery, no love, no affection, no affirmation, nothing but his own wits and studied determination to carry him into each terrifying day. Now his brothers stood there before him. His brothers. These were his own flesh and blood, the ones who had abused and sold him. He should hate and punish them. But in spite of himself, Joseph wanted nothing in the world more than to be loved by his brothers and his father. Oh, how he yearned for the affection of his father. His brothers stood there before him, confused, afraid. They had no idea this Egyptian official was the brother they had betrayed. "Get out of here," Joseph shouted through his tears to all the Egyptians in the room. "Get out, I want to be alone with these men." Then he turned on his brothers. "I am Joseph. I am your little brother. Do you perhaps remember me?" They dropped to the ground, terrified. Then the hiss of his first challenge broke. "Is father still alive?" Only Judah managed to raise his head enough to nod a wary yes to Joseph's plea. But then again the tears broke. Joseph knew how much he wanted to be loved, to be accepted by his brothers, and yet his anger at them boiled inside. It's all right, my brothers. In his desperate need for love, Joseph stifled his anger and told the pious lie. God arranged it all. God knows there'd be a famine in this land, so God put me here in the Egyptian court so I could take care of you and my father and our whole tribe. It wasn't your fault, you see. Joseph walked up to Benjamin, his youngest brother, and embraced him again. Oh, Ben, it's so good to see you. How is Dad? Tell me how my father is. Benjamin swallowed hard. He's fine, just fine. Tell Dad that I'm alive. I'm okay. And tell him I've done real well. Tell him I'm in charge of just about everything here, that I'm second in command to Pharaoh. Tell him that, will you, Ben? Ben nodded, still dazed. Joseph wondered why he'd said that. Why was it so important to have his dad know of his success? It took days before Joseph and his brothers cut through the years of fear and anger and repression to really talk with each other. One day, Joseph found again the anger he had hidden, enough that he could shout his rage, "Why did you do that to me?" But there was, of course, no longer any answer. Then one day there was confession. One by one, the brothers, Joseph too, found words to name their sins. One by one, they asked forgiveness from each other and from God. One by one, they vowed to purge their lives of jealousy and greed that brought them to such deeds. Now the tears flowed freely, and sometimes laughter too, as brothers saw each other now as fragile, lonely men who needed more than anything the care and love that only they could give each other. The God of our ancestors did not lead us to abuse and betray you, Joseph, Judah said one day. Our God is a just and loving God and would never will such things. But God has used our weakness and our sin, and through it has brought life to Egypt and our father's clan. Thanks be to God. Thanks be to God, repeated Joseph and his brothers. I don't know whether you have had the beautiful opportunity of having a shattered friendship or a shattered family reconciled and made new. If you have, you will know that that's one of those experiences through which God is trying to speak to you. This is how it happens. Speaking of relationships being shattered, I wondered one time what it was like for the disciples between Good Friday and Easter Sunday morning. The Saturday would have been the Jewish Sabbath. What did they do? How did they feel? And what I did, I wrote a story on. That's what I always do when I try to sort out my mind. Mary of Magdala walked slowly down the cold street of Jerusalem. It was the Sabbath morning, but it didn't feel like Sabbath. Mary had no idea where she was going. After a sleepless night, she was just walking. Around the corner of a narrow street, she saw a figure huddled in the deep morning shadows. A man, a large man, hunched up in fetal agony. Peter, said Mary, Simon Peter. There was no response except a slight drawing up of legs closer to the body. Mary hadn't really needed to ask, and she didn't ask permission to sit down beside the desperately unhappy man shivering against the cold white wall. For perhaps an hour, she sat there, this is computer. For perhaps an hour she sat with him, there were no words. Finally, Mary spoke. If there is such a thing as hell on earth, this must be it. Another long silence. Did you hear about Judas? Peter mumbled. No. He's dead too. Killed himself. Oh God, said Mary. Well, damn it, Mary, maybe that's the sensible thing to do. Yeah, I know what you mean. I can't get his face out of my mind, Mary. I keep seeing it all the time. It's just there, and it won't go away. I saw his face, Mary, right after the rooster crowed, right after I'd been swearing up and down I didn't know him, but that I'd never seen him, and then I saw his face, and I can't get it out of my head. I guess Jesus was pretty hurt, Mary said. Then suddenly she turned angrily toward Peter. He should have been mad. That was a dirty, cowardly thing to do, Peter. You think I don't know that, says Peter. That's why his face keeps bugging me. He wasn't mad. He wasn't hurt. He looked, you know the way he would look at us sometimes after we'd been talking about something, and you could just read the affection in his face. There was love in his face when he looked at me, Mary, and it's driving me nuts. Do you know, Mary began to weep, do you know what he said when they hoisted him up on that cross? I can't even imagine the pain he was going through, but he said, God forgive them. They don't know what they are doing. They are tearing his body apart, and he says, forgive them. Mary wept quietly for a while. Peter buried his head in his cloak. Both of them sat in silence for many long minutes. I remember when I first saw him in Magdala, said Mary. I swore at him the first time I saw him. I told him to get out of my life. He wouldn't go. Just like that face in your head, I guess, Peter. Jesus kept hanging around our village, and I kept telling him to get lost. But one day, I didn't tell him to get lost, and we started talking. There hasn't been a day since then that I haven't talked to him. Mary again began to weep. Peter, this is the first day since I met him that I haven't had at least some kind of conversation with Jesus. Were you in love with him? For the first time in the conversation, Peter raised his head to look at her. Mary said nothing, but Peter saw the question had been heard. He waited. Yes, yes, deeply and terribly, I still am. But I don't know how to love a man like that. He was a man. I've had other men. I thought I knew exactly what to do with him, how to handle him. But he was more than a man, or at least a different kind of man, and that confused me. He wanted to talk to me, wanted to hear what I had to say. He was the first man that ever respected me, and I never quite knew what to do with that, how to respond to him. When he looked at me that way, just as you say, with that deep affection in his eyes. Still, I would have gone to bed with him in a minute if he'd approached me. Did he? No. I think he loved more than my body, though he may have loved that too. I think he loved me the way he loved you. Then very quickly she added, did you know how much he loved you, Peter? Peter's head went down inside his cloak. Then slowly the tears began, quiet tears at first, then bursting into a body shattering quake and screeching anger. Damn him anyway. He knew I was a worthless turd when we first met, but he could never accept that. Why didn't he just spit in my eye? Then I could have gone and hung myself like Judas and be done with it. Why did he have to look at me like that? Why, Mary? Peter sobbed like a child, and Mary's hand reached out to his. She joined his weeping. You know something, Peter? Not all of him has died. That's why we're sitting here bawling like a couple of babies. I've got that look in my head, too. I saw it on his face just before he died. That love didn't die, Peter. We still love him, and he somehow still loves us. That isn't dead. Peter squeezed Mary's hand so hard it almost hurt. The love is still there, Mary. But the dreams have died. I guess the only thing we can do now is try to live without them. What are you going to do now, Mary? Well, tomorrow I need to go and do the right things for his body. At the very least, I want what's left of his body to have some dignity in death. And then, oh, I don't know. There's nothing back in Magdala for me. What about you, Peter? back to the Galilee, I suppose. I'll go back fishing. It's the only thing I know how to do. Walk with me for a while, Peter. Walking helps. Mary took Peter's strong and calloused hand. As they walked into the brightness of the spring morning, the warmth of sun brought the promise of healing. Peter even managed a slight smile. You're right, Mary. They couldn't kill the part of him that loves. That's all we've got left to hang on to. Any responses or reactions to that? Anybody wants to name? Problems? This is purely imaginary, this thing. This comes, there is absolutely nothing in scripture or in tradition, as far as I know. There may be something in the Midrash tradition of the Jewish people, but for me, I'm not aware of anything that's written there, and it's just sort of imagination. The thing about a story like that is you're probably coming to realize that when you tell a story, the story tells you. And when you listen to a story, if you listen deeply, you will find that the story becomes partly yours. Because in any communication, the words that are said by the speaker are only half of the communication. The other half is the person listening, or the person's listening. I sometimes preach a sermon in church called How to Listen to a Sermon. And one of the things I say to people in the congregation is, if you hear a bad sermon, it's at least half your fault. But it is true that you, each of you, listen to this from your own perspective, from your own life, from your own experience, and you identify or you see things through the lens of your own experience, through your own life. All of us are deeply prejudiced, and that's not bad, that's simply the way we are, and every one of us is an individual. And every one of us sees God in a slightly different way. That's why there's all these many, and hundreds more. I have a list here that Heidi Schneider gave me. Where is it? Somebody wanted a copy of it, that's why I brought it along. But this list here, 100 names for God. 100 names. Just. I want this back very badly, but just pass it on so you can look at it a little bit. Just, you don't have to read them all, but just...
Can I interject for a minute?
Yeah.
I've been reading Spawn the last few days.
Uh-huh.
And he was asking questions about looking into the Jewish history, Midrash, about the same Easter event. And so for the last few days, I've had him take this little piece apart, that little piece apart, this little piece apart, and I get down to what was the Easter story.
Mm-hmm.
And I hear an answer for me at this point in my life, in what you said this morning.
Okay.
That is a different kind of answer. It's not an historical answer. It's not a something that I can put a lot of words around, but there was Spong saying, well, these things were not quite what you thought they were. And in what you were trying to put this morning, I could hear something that touched me and left me with far more important feelings than he is a theologian.
Well, I have no, I've
And I'm your wife.
Yes, I know.
Still a
I'm aware of that. I think the far right of the church that wants to keep the scriptures firm and immutable and so forth, the far right of the church that says everything in the Bible is exactly as it is written, word for word, and the far left of the church, the Jesus Seminar and Bishop Spong and the others, both of them make the same mistake. They don't hear the story as story, first of all. I have no problem with people digging behind these things, but first you should fall in love with the story. Let the story speak to you simply as a story. And when it's done that work, And Walter Brueggemann, one of the finest biblical scholars, says, let the story have its way with you, first of all. Do that first. Then, when you are thoroughly, the story has done its work in your soul, then go and read the scholars, and you can add all kinds of depth and stuff to it that will make the stories come even more alive. Like if you had been with Jan in the Bible study, how many of you were watching, listening to Jan? You know, I mean, these wonderful insights that shine new light on the story. You can see it from many, many perspectives. Okay, take it down to the next morning. I have done a lot of stories about Mary of Magdala because I have, as Bev will tell you, a habit of falling in love with women who have been dead quite a long time. A few years ago, we went to Britain and I fell in love with Julian of Norwich. Somehow Bev doesn't seem to feel very threatened by that. She's been dead 400 years, and Mary of Magdala, well, close to almost 2,000. But Mary of Magdala is a shadowy figure in the Bible. She's there, and yet she sometimes isn't. But we do know that she was a very important and powerful figure in the early church. There is some feeling that she may have been a very important person in the Gnostic churches, which we didn't know very much about until some scrolls were unearthed just a few years ago in Egypt that gave us some information about the Gnostics, who were sort of different kinds, different denominations of Christianity, if you like. And there was obviously a knockdown, drag-em-out fight between the Gnostic Church and the Apostolic Church, the Church of Rome as we know it now, and the Church of Rome won. I don't know what our Christianity would have been like if the others had won, but Mary of Magdala was far more important to the early church than the scriptures tell us. This much I am sure of. She is known by some as the patron saint of preachers. It's very interesting that the patron saint of preachers is female. There is a stained glass window in a church in Spain somewhere that shows her preaching to the apostles. She fulfills all the categories of being an apostle that Paul outlined, and yet she isn't in that list. So anyway, I find that Mary has a lot more to say to me than some of the others. This is now the Sunday morning after the night before we just read about. Mary stumbled and fell in the dark, her hand and elbow scraped against the ugly rocks, and though she couldn't see it, she knew she was bleeding. No matter, she had bled before. On she stumbled through the clutching darkness, along a half-remembered path. She felt her way up to the garden tomb. Gradually, the cold gray light of early dawn outlined the naked rock that should have sealed the tomb, the place where they had buried her best friend. The reality, the horror, hit her instantly. Even in his death, they could not give him peace. This kind and gentle friend had died the cruel death of criminals, and now, to add to all the insult, someone had stolen Jesus' body. Screaming, she crashed back down the path to the house where she'd been mourning, Jesus' death since that horror-filled Friday. Screaming, she yelled for Peter, for the others. They've taken him away. Damn them anyway. They wouldn't let him rest. Peter, come. They've stolen Jesus' body. Oh, my God, how can people be so brutal? Now, again with Peter, she scrabbled up the path toward the tomb. Her rage carried her now. Her unfocused anger at this outrage carried her thoughts to bitter morning darkness up the broken path. Rocks and bushes scratched and tore her skin until she stood, chest heaving, beside Peter at the open tomb. Then she and Peter forced themselves to believe the unbelievable. He's gone, Mary. There was stunned deadness in his voice. All they left us was a corpse. Now they've got that too. And Peter stumbled off, going nowhere but away from this revolting desecration. Mary stayed. She had nowhere to go. She had nothing left. The power of her rage was spent. She was exhausted. she slumped her deadened body up against a rock. Head in hands, she sat, her mind shut down. She felt nothing, not even the will to die. Then memories. Memories of terror, memories of despair. The pain of hometown life of Magdala came back, back in all its horrors. The darkness of her life in that small town where she was beaten, starved, and raped, where people called her slut and whore, though she was neither, where she was called possessed of seven demons. It wasn't until she remembered overhearing rumors of a healer just down the lakeside at Capernaum that a sense of feeling returned, and with the feeling, tears. Tears that slowly washed her dry, red, angry eyes. Tears that moved to moans, then into her body heaving sobs. Great gasping, screaming cries that found their way from the bottom of her wounded soul. Through the prism of tears, she saw the light of dawn slanting through the rocks into the garden. And there, in that golden light, a figure, a man. It could be any man. It must be the gardener. Who else would be there in this place so early? Look, if you took his body, tell me where. Please, just tell me where so I can go and get him and give him a decent human burial. Tell me, for God's sake, tell me. Mary. The voice was gentle. It seemed to come from another world. It took some moments to move its way through her sobs and into her consciousness. She heard it a second time. Mary. Through her tears, through her salted tears of pain and anger and rejection, Mary saw him. Rabbi, she whispered, and then shouted, Rabbi! Springing to her feet to embrace him, the light of morning sparkling through her tears, Mary rushed towards Jesus. Please don't touch me, Mary, he said. There are reasons. Don't be afraid, Mary. Go and tell our friends that death has been transformed to life and that despair has turned to hope. This time the path unrolled beneath her dancing feet. This time the amber rocks and greening bushes sparkled in the morning light. This time she shouted hope to all her friends. I have seen him. He's alive. It's true. All that he said is true. God loves us, all of us, and death and pain are not the end of life.
That when I'm listening to what I really agree with you on making sure the story stays a story first and foremost, that that there are two ways to know. One is through reason. One is through the ability that God has given us to love God with our mind. But the other really comes to us sometimes through experience. And sometimes we know the truth by what we've experienced, even sometimes when it flies against the face of what our reason has led us to at some point. And I guess that if I may share a little vignette here about this story and how it impacted me personally. Mm-hmm. My first call as a pastor was as an associate pastor in Western Washington in a small congregation. And I think one thing that most people going out of seminary and whatever dream about doing is preaching their first Easter Sunday.
Oh boy.
And I was so excited when Easter came, but then I realized that was the associate. And the chances of me preaching on Easter were probably pretty slim.
Mm-hmm.
But the pastor I worked with was pretty gracious, and we got to talking about it, and he said, you know, I remember how important my first Easter was, and he said, how about we co-preach this? So we began to talk about how to approach the Easter story, one of us from resurrection, from the reality of our reason, which was him, and me from the reality of experience. And so we were excited about this. Well, before the service started, I was at the front door greeting people as they came in the door. And people were coming in, and I was just so excited. It was just the highest day of my life up to that point, it seemed. And a gentleman walked in, and he took a bulletin for me. I greeted him with Christ is risen, he's risen, dead. And he walked in, and then he stopped. He turned around, he came back. And he said to me, who's in charge here? And I said, huh? Huh? I didn't know what he was asking. He said, I want to know who's in charge here. And I said, well, I don't know how to answer the question. He said, I want to know who's preaching today. And I said, well, I am. handed me the bulletin. He says, well, I guess I cannot stay then.
Oh.
And he turned around, he left, and he walked out to the parking lot. It was like a knife got thrust into my heart deeply. And I turned around to the window, and the tears started to come. And there were the two women, or I don't know, was reading at the door, the other ushers, but one of them saw me, came to me and said, you all right? And I told her what I did, what had happened. And these two overheard it, and they said, let's go get him! No. And it took me a long time to compose myself. But then it was halfway down the aisle, on the Easter processional, to Jesus Christ is risen today, that I started to laugh. And I laughed so hard, I was bumping into the pews, I was stumbling into the pastor next to me, and I think they didn't know what the world had happened to me. I realized that if that man had been there Easter morning, he would not have believed Mary Magdalene.
That's right.
He would not have heard the resurrection. And here I was, walking in her footsteps, generations later, privileged to be the preacher of the gospel.
One of the thing that spawned that story, and that is always very moving, when you read that story in the Gospel of John, I think it is, it is through her tears that she sees the risen Christ. That's always been so significant for me, because so often it is through tears, like your tears, and through tears of other people, it is in those moments of deep pain that suddenly we are able to see the risen Christ. I find that a very moving and powerful thing. Those of you who are pastors or who have done pastoral work will know how often it is that when there is a death in the family or a deep crisis in the family, how often it is that that becomes the point when people change something about their lives, and they may find themselves coming into church or trying to do something else with their lives. It seems to me really important to realize that it's through the tears that people see the risen Christ. Thank you, Jan, for that story. That's really good. Easter is, of course, the traditional time for baptism, for new life to happen, for new beginnings. But I don't think new beginnings sort of happen unless there is a really strong awareness of where we have been. And yes, you can see that rationally sometimes, but you do need to feel it with your heart and let the experience speak to you. Yesterday, I said, I hope I said, that one of the primary ways God speaks to us is through experience, that God doesn't necessarily speak English, French, or German, Norwegian, or Swedish, or Latin. And somebody asked me if that was the only way that God could speak, and of course not. Of course not. God is not limited by anything. But certainly it is the experiences of pain and joy, those deep moments, those are doors through which we can find our way into the presence of the risen Christ. And that's why I believe so strongly that the entryway into a Christian faith is not through academic work. I'm not at all down on academic work. I don't mean that. What I mean is that the gas in your tank, put it this way, when you run out of gas on the road, you don't go to a library, you go to a filling station. A library is a very good place to go, and I go there often, but when you're out of gas, you need gas. You need that which motivates you, and that is at the non-rational level. I am firmly convinced that one of the things that our ecumenical church needs more than anything is a strong spiritual revival, some way that we can speak much more openly and accurately and passionately about our faith without turning our theology into kindergarten stuff. Maintaining our integrity, keeping our reason there looking at us and saying, hey, that doesn't make sense, look at that again. Go and dig behind that story again and see what more is there and so forth. Yes, we need to do that study. But first of all, we need to find a way in our ecumenical church.
Ralph?
Yes?
The beautiful part of all of this is it gives us an insight into what eternal life is all about.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I hope so. Where am I out here? I lost my place. Okay. I would like to read you one last story, and I'm saving this for the last because of almost anything I have written, this is, for me, my favorite. So I get, since I'm up here and you're down there, I get to do what I like. This is written as prose, but it really is a poem. Am I just sentimental? Or is it true that spring on the prairies is more passionate and fun? I live in the Okanagan Valley now, where springtime kind of seeps in slowly underneath the door. On the prairies, springtime comes like that. Bam, you shovel out the snowstorm one day, and the next there's balm on the breeze. The swift seduction of a prairie spring sweeps you away with a warm and passionate kiss, loves you quickly into summer, and is gone. A short, surprising love affair with life. When spring hits the prairies, it thaws. Wow, does it thaw. The sloughs fill up and the ditches run full, and children quickly trade their winter long johns for gumboots and go looking for rubber ice to dance on. Do you know what rubber ice is? It only happens in a slough or a hollow where the water is exactly 1 inch deeper than a 9-year-old boy's rubber boots. It happens overnight, a thin plastic layer, not like ordinary ice. Rubber ice is flexible and, well, rubbery. Adults have no idea what to do with rubber ice, but a child knows. You have to dance it. I am 9 years old, and I can dance. One slow and lingering step, and I can feel the ice sink slightly, sending snaps and crackles detonating through the slough. I have 9-year-old skill and 9-year-old rhythm. I am 9, and I know this dance. I test the ice with each slow step and know exactly when to move just as the ice begins to crack. Quickly, not too fast, a gliding, slow ballet, always moving forward because to stop, even for a second, is to break the ice. Nor can you go back to ice you've danced before because it is weak. But there is always lots of future, lots of ice to draw you on, dancing, moving forward, just at the moment when the ice begins to sink beneath your feet. I get a little braver, stay a little longer on each spot. My dance slows as I dare the ice to break, push the edges of my springtime passion, test the boundaries of my boyhood. And the ice will break. Eventually, it always does. And I run wet and shivering and defeated to my mom, who drives me off and scolds me softly and talks about pneumonia. Ah, Mom, my feet aren't even a teensy bit cold. It's boiling out there. There is gentleness in Mother's scolding, and sometimes just a hint of laughter. I think maybe Mom remembers rubber ice when she was 9. Spring on the prairies is a quick, passionate affair with life. Rubber ice to dance on, swimming holes to freeze in, feet to go barefoot on. Then spring is gone and the hot summer is upon us. Time to get to work. Time to live a thing called hope. Those who farm the dry and unforgiving prairies know about hope. Yes, hope. Not bloody-minded positive thinking, not gritting your teeth and toughing it out till the economy improves, not even optimism. It's embracing the glory, the passion of life, and accepting the crud that infects it, and the pain. Springtime has taught you that you will break through, and your boots will fill up, but not to dance the ice is to deny the gift of life with all its pleasure and its passion and its pain. To refuse the springtime teaching of rubber ice is to say no to summer hope. Hope, real hope, is deeper than mere optimism. It's not at all like cranking up a positive attitude. It's not the phony power think of real estate salespeople. There's nothing Pollyanna about it. You can't describe hope or teach it, but you can see it sometimes, and you can live it. I've seen hope in the swollen belly of my daughter when she bore our grandchild. I've seen hope in the face of a tired street worker, showing a broken woman where she can get a bit of rest, a sense of safety, and a shower. I've seen hope in the eyes of a friend dying from cancer, convinced her life would not end when her body died. I've seen hope in the wrinkled face of my grandmother, who lay on her bed and told me, "I'm just waiting for my Jesus." I experience hope every time I plant a seed, or tell a story to my grandchild, or sit with Bev, my mate of almost 40 years, and hold her hand and listen to the heartbeat of our life, and remember how we've danced the rubber ice together. I know about hope because as a small boy, I learned to dance the rubber ice and feel the passion of a prairie springtime. And I found a mom that I could run to in my prayers, a mother who danced the rubber ice and showed me something of the face of God. Friends, I'd like to thank you for this experience here. This is our first time at Holden Village. We knew virtually nothing about it before we came. Lots of things were a surprise. But I think I speak for Bev, too, that I say that we have thoroughly enjoyed ourselves. The worship has been wonderful and beautiful and moving and has spoken to us. Because quite often, as you know, in churches sometimes, the worship is sometimes a little arid. It wasn't here. It was juicy and alive, and we loved it. And we have enjoyed the many, many conversations we have had with you. So this place and the spirit it generates is a wonderful resource. Care for it and care for each other. Thank you very much.